welcome to episode 5 of the Ubuntu UK podcast with
Simon,
Davey,
Alan,
and I'm Tony.
On the show this week,
we're going to interview Pete Savage.
We're going to talk to Laura about CLI versus GUI. We have Hardy install experiences.
We've got more sarcastic news.
And have a chat with Phil Newbra.
And we're going to give you the results of the competition.
And read out your emails.
Sounds like a fun-packed show.
Let's get on with it. We have Pete Savage, who has a presence on pretty much every Ubuntu machine on the planet. Pete, how did that happen?
That happened because I took it upon myself to design the startup sound for Ubuntu.
The funky drums and stuff.
Does it
have a name?
The edgy dance, as it was coined at one of the conferences, I think.
The edgy dance?
Yeah.
And is there a dance to go with it?
I've never seen the dance. I wasn't at a conference, but...
That's probably for the best, to be honest.
I think so.
'Cause I'm sure Tony at this point can insert the sound. You did a startup and a shutdown, and what else?
I actually only did a startup and a shutdown.
And the shutdown, nobody hears anymore, do they?
No, nobody hears anymore because the teardown's too quick.
It shuts down too quickly. For how long was the shutdown music?
Oh, it was only about 2 or 3 seconds.
But the machine shut down so quick, you can't hear it.
So how did you make the sounds? How did you make the music?
Well, it was all done using open source tools, using the Ardour package, which is a fantastic multi-tracker. A lot of people say it's very difficult to learn how to use, and I'd agree that if you haven't used multi-trackers before, it's a bit daunting, but after you use it for a bit, it's fine. It's a really nice package to use and produces some really great results. I decided I was going to create these sounds, and I had a Korg X5D keyboard, which is where a lot of the sounds came from, and just played around with it. I did about 10 sounds or so, and posted them up on the wiki and said to people, you know, have a look, give me some comments on what you like and don't like. And then I coordinated with one of the art directors at the time, which was Frank Schwab, and we took them to Mark and said, do you want to have a listen and tell us which ones you like? And he picked the one out, which I must admit was the one that I preferred.
The one that we currently have?
The one that we currently have, yeah, but we cut it down considerably. It was about 12 seconds to begin with, and that was the length of time it took for my desktop to start up. But everybody else, it seems to be a lot shorter, so they said, no, it goes on way too long.
Yeah, people are already browsing the web by the time you're starting.
Exactly. Yeah.
What sort of feedback did you have?
We had very, very good feedback, actually. There was a lot of comments on the Ubuntu wiki, and I think they're all still there, and all the links to all the original sounds that I created are still there. In fact, the sound changed quite considerably. Originally, it had we started off with a very low bit sound, so we took it down to about 8 bits and really bit crunched it, so it sounded very tinny and very distorted. And then as it moved through, it faded from that to a very high quality version.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it was kind of like a transition to show how you were moving into a different world as you were loading up Ubuntu. But unfortunately, that wasn't so well received, so we cut that out and we just went with the standard sound. And one of the sounds I still use, I use on my phone as an SMS message receiver tone. It works quite well.
And it's still in Ubuntu now?
It is. I'm really surprised, actually. Somebody filed a bug against it in Launchpad as well.
Really?
There was a Launchpad bug saying, please revert the edgy sounds.
Oh, God. Oh,
back to the ones that were in Dapper.
Do you know, I can't even remember the sound that was in Dapper.
Nope.
I can't.
You've also been involved in the Edubuntu project. What's Edubuntu all about?
Edubuntu used to be a almost a separate distro with Ubuntu as its base. Now it's moved more to be an add-on CD, and that's the way it's going to be moving towards, I think.
And what do you get in Edubuntu that you don't get in standard Ubuntu or Kubuntu or Zubuntu?
Edubuntu was primarily geared towards the educational sector and had different packages pre-installed with educational tools and different artwork and things like that.
Designed for kids or...?
Yeah, originally designed more for kids, but when I was involved, we were trying to gear it more towards education in general and providing different themes and tools so that it would be happily placed at university level and college level as well.
And do you know if it's being used heavily or is it...
We were getting quite a few people come back and say, I'm using this in the classroom. It was getting getting very heavily used, I think, more in third world countries and places like that.
It uses LTSP, doesn't it?
The thin client system. Very easy to set up. In fact, the Edubuntu install disk that we used to use, I can't say about the current one because I haven't used it, but the one that we used to use in Edu and Feisty had the LTSP system all installed when you installed the server. And you could then just quite happily boot up clients. They'd pick up an IP address from that server, and the IP address, the DHCP server would also send out information about the TFTP file and where it should download it. And it would then download a very, very thinned down Linux OS, which basically just consisted of an X server. And it would then boot back off of the main server, and you'd be using a graphical terminal which was actually present on the server instead of running anything off the client. So
you could use like really thin, you know, almost dumb terminal, like
exactly.
Desktops. Oh, cool.
And of course, it's very good from a administration point of view. If you want to install an application on everybody's machine, you just install it on the server and it magically appears on everybody's machine. No reboots, no nothing.
And are there admin tools built into it that are suitable for administering internet access and things for school children?
Yeah, I believe they were being developed at the time. We were working on developing those, and I actually worked on Thin Client Manager, which was kind of a administration system. Just when I stopped working on it, we were just getting to the stage where you could watch people's screens and then blank their screen out. You could log them off. You could send them a message. You could. It was coming along quite nicely.
So did you actually use VNC for that, or was that something else you used to actually monitor?
That was VNC, yeah. We were looking at writing a kind of a driver that would work on the client itself and build it into the X server, but no, we were actually using VNC to begin with, and as such it was a little slow and it required some optimising, but we got there in the end.
And was there actually content filtering included in the distro, like Dan's Guardian or something similar?
It was being worked on, but at the time when I was working on it, I don't think it was actually put in place and finished. Not in an easy form of use anyway, but it was being worked on.
Do you know what sort of deployments and things it's got, whether it's got any large take-up?
I don't know. We got quite a few people coming back and saying, oh, I'm using this in a fairly large establishment. And indeed, one of the things that I was trying to do when I was there was to consolidate this information and put it up somewhere so people could go along and see, you know, who was using this. But it was one of the many things that we tried to do, and I never really got around to doing.
So you don't work on Edubuntu anymore at the moment?
Not at the moment, no. My time has been taken up with many other things.
And one of those other things is video podcast that you've put together called Progbox.
Indeed, Progbox, yeah.
What made you decide to create a video podcast?
I first of all decided I wanted to do an audio podcast, and then I decided that nobody would really want to listen to my voice for half an hour.
We think the same thing. You'd be surprised.
So I decided I'd make it a bit more interesting and turn it into a video podcast. And it basically started as can I actually do this using, you know, free software? Is this actually going to be possible? Can I do all the video editing? And with the equipment that I had, because I don't have a proper video camera at all, I'm using an Olympus C8080 still camera, just switching it to video mode. It was basically a challenge to myself. Can I do this? Can I make it interesting? And are people actually going to watch it?
What tools do you use?
I'm currently using KDEN Live, which is a nice video editor. When I first started using it, it crashed a lot, but then Keynote crashed about the same amount. So this was, you know, a couple of years back, so I never really looked at it much again. Really easy to use. Doing video transitions like fades, picture-in-picture, things like that.
Pete, have you thought about accessibility of your video cast, subtitles and things like that? Is something that you maybe want to aim towards?
I have indeed, and I was actually asked by somebody, you know, are you going to put subtitle support in because I'm deaf and I'd really like to, you know, watch the podcast. And I talked to, the main way I distribute the video at the moment is through Miro. And I asked the guys at Miro, do you have subtitle support? And they said, no. So I think it's something they're working on, but currently we don't have subtitle support on there.
Who's your target audience?
Target audience is anyone really who's interested in open source, computers in general, technology, and just trying to, you know, raise awareness of some cool things that I've found so that other people can have a go with them and maybe take them on and expand them further.
How often do you plan to put an episode out?
At the moment, it's a kind of when I can. it's supposed to be monthly, but if I can do it more than monthly, then that's also good for me. I'm in discussion with some other people who've got some interest in producing a video cast, and so we're wondering whether we can kind of amalgamate them all together under the Progbox name, but kind of rotate it so each person would do one, and then we could possibly release, you know, once a week even. And with the option of, if you get on better with somebody's podcast, you could just have their feed, whereas if you want to get all of them, you could use the generic feed and get everybody.
Right.
I just wanted to ask, is it true that you chose to do a video podcast rather than audio one so that people can admire your hair?
No. Surprisingly, I have had comments about my hair, most notably from you, Tony, who always seems to find new and interesting ways to comment on my hair on whichever website a picture of me happens to be.
That's because you always have new and interesting hair.
It's true.
Well, thanks very much for coming on the show, Pete, and give us the URL to your website, so if anyone wants to watch the video, they know where to go.
Okay, the URL is progbox.co.uk, and you can find all the information there.
Great stuff. Thanks, Pete.
Cheers, brilliant. Pete. Thank you, Pete.
Thank you.
Cheers.
In episode 3, we talked about the command line and GUIs, and actually while we were there doing our piece, someone was sat in the corner of the room itching to speak but didn't have a microphone. Now you do, Laura. What was it you were getting so angry about?
Basically, I agree with the idea that if you have to drop to the command line in Ubuntu, it's a bug, as long as you qualify that as doing tasks that a normal person would do. Reconfiguring an Apache server I don't consider a normal task, so I think that's fair enough that you'd have to drop to the command line. But if you expect somebody frequently to have to use the command line to
connect to the internet, or
connect to the internet, or mount a USB drive, or get music onto their iPod, or whatever, I think that is a bug, because your average person doesn't care about Linux under the covers. They just want to use a computer as a tool.
So is that more in the desktop environment?
Yes.
You shouldn't have to use a command line, but in a server or advanced administration environment, you should or would expect to?
Yeah, I mean, normal everyday things like email, getting photos off a digital camera, editing your photos, even making little movies and things. It doesn't have to be like a video cast or anything, it could just be a home movie. That sort of thing your average person could do on Windows or a Mac or whatever, and they should be able to do that on Ubuntu as well. That's
so
the point.
So having to drop to the command line to use a command like FFmpeg to doing re-encoding of stuff is a bug, really. It should be wrapped around in a GUI or something like that.
One of the things you were talking about was that a GUI is for new users and a command line is for experienced users, which I don't think is quite right either, because command line is fine for if you want to do certain things and you want to do them fast or you want to do them repetitively or whatever. Mm-hmm. I use Ubuntu on the desktop, and I've used Linux on the desktop for quite a few years now, and I get really irritated if I have to use a command line to do some basic thing like mount a USB key, because for whatever reason it's not worked.
What is it that makes you cross or angry or annoyed at having to drop to the command line? Is it just the annoyance that, oh, I have to learn something that I don't I shouldn't have to, it should be a button? Or
I think it's if I've not done it frequently, I just don't remember it. So it means I've got to go and look it up, which is time out from what I'm trying to do.
Right, you're wasting time and wasting brain capacity on stuff like obscure command line parameters.
I just want to get the photos off the camera. One thing was that, like I said, when you were talking new users and experienced and things, there's this kind of attitude, not just here in general, that a GUI is kind of just a front end bolted onto a command line functionality or a script or whatever, which, if it's a well-designed GUI, it isn't that. When I was at FOSDEM in February, I went to a Debian accessibility session, and the presenter there did a really good presentation about the issues about making a GUI screen reader accessible and why you should do it and the benefits and things like that. One of the people in the audience asked a question saying that, why do we need to bother? Can't a blind person use the command line? Because the command line will work well with a screen reader because it's all text. There's no pictures and there's no two-dimensional layout to deal with or anything.
Nothing
like that.
Nothing that's going to get confused by.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, if all the GUI is a visual representation of the command line, then you could possibly say that. But a well-designed GUI completely changes the experience. It fits what the user is trying to do and how they think and how they expect to interact with the machine. If you want to reheat last night's takeaway, and you're tired, you're hungover, and you're hungry, and you don't really want to have to think up the correct sequence of commands to enter to do that, you just want to do it because you want to get to your food. Think like that when you're thinking about putting a digital camera into a laptop, plugging it in, getting photos off. You don't care how it interacts with the system. You don't want to go to lots of trouble to make it work. It should just work, which on Ubuntu, on the whole, it does now.
So I should always, whenever I picture myself doing something on Ubuntu, I should think of myself being tired, hungry, and hungover. Whenever I do it, and that will make me think of the GUI.
It's not just thinking of the GUI, it's just making it easy and not expecting people to have to go look it up in the documentation.
Sure.
And I'm a technical writer, so I appreciate documentation, but I don't appreciate having to go look things up and Google it, which is one of the comments last in the episode that you were talking about.
Sorry. Well, thanks for that feedback. I appreciate it. And sorry you had to sit there in pain when we actually recorded the episode first time without a microphone. Are you going to stick around for the rest of the show?
Yeah.
Cool. So have we upgraded to Hardy yet?
Yep.
Right, so how did you upgrade then? How did you upgrade to Hardy?
Well, I tried to upgrade using the Update Manager, and I clicked the little button where it said there is a new release available. Click here to upgrade.
When was this? After the release date, yeah?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, a day or two after the release date. And the first thing it did was blat all the sources of my local mirrors.
Now, this is a funny thing, because Tony has... You've got your own local mirror, your own copy.
Yeah, I run apt mirror, which creates a whole copy of any particular archive, so I have told it to mirror all the Hardy packages. So when I want to install something, it installs over my LAN rather than over the internet, and things like OpenOffice.org updates don't take 2 years to download and install. It's already there.
It's really useful if you've got multiple machines, I guess.
Exactly,
running the same version.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So you've got your local mirror,
yeah,
and you hit the button in Update Manager to say, I want to upgrade to the new release.
Yes.
And it just went horribly wrong? Or it just didn't use your local mirror?
It just didn't use my local mirror. So all it's got to do is replace Gutsy in the sources list with Hardy, rather than blatting all of the lines that are in your sources list and overwriting them. But if you've got your own local repo, you're probably a competent enough sysadmin to know what to do in terms of editing sources.list.
Yeah.
But it would be lovely just to be able to click on the icon and do it in the GUI the same way as everybody else does, because I end up doing it on the command line using aptitude and aptitude dist upgrade.
I mean, obviously the question is, have you filed a bug against Update Manager?
No.
Well, there you go.
You will have.
Shut up then.
By the time our audience listens to this.
I may have done. There may well already be one. To be honest, I haven't looked. It was a bit of an annoyance last time around, and it was still annoying this time around. But I do it once every 6 months, and it doesn't really annoy me enough to get me off my backside to file a bug.
So that aside, you've upgraded and everything's fine?
Yes, actually. I was really pleased and quite impressed. There were more things fixed in Hardy than broke, which is good for me, on my Samsung Q45 laptop, which is the only machine I've upgraded so far. There were a couple of broken packages when I was actually doing the upgrade that meant I had to run dist upgrade a couple of times. I somehow ended up with the Zubuntu GDM, the login screen, which I'm not quite sure how I ended up with that. Desktop effects now works on my laptop, so I can get all the slidey, spinny, uppy, downy goodness.
And do you use it?
It's on by default now, so yeah.
Oh, okay.
The resolution is now okay on my Q45.
Oh, it was wrong resolution previously.
It didn't support the widescreen resolution.
So Intel graphics card?
Yeah, Intel graphics card. And Alan, during one of our podcast recordings, rather brave, he said, oh, I'll fix that for you. I have tried, Alan. Oh, no, I shall fix it for you. And after 20 minutes, grumpily admitted that he might have been defeated by this. But thankfully, it is fixed properly in Hardy. And, even better, the VGA out now works, so I can now use my laptop for presentations.
How often do you do that?
Well, now I can do it more often. and it's configurable via the screen resolution config tool as well, so I didn't need to edit any config files.
So overall, on a score out of 5, how would you say the upgrade experience and post-upgrade has gone?
I'm going to go like 4.5. Out of five. Yeah. Suspend and hibernate now seem to work as well.
So what was your experience? When did you upgrade?
I upgraded on this laptop quite early on in the release cycle.
That's a ThinkPad X series, by the way.
Yes, the X61 swirly top.
Tablet, I think
yes,
you'll find the word.
Yes. I upgraded using the... I actually changed the source packet, the source list.
Work all right?
Yeah. I mean, this one is quite an old one, and I'd probably like to do a fresh install to test it better. I only tried Suspend recently, and that didn't work. This is quite a messy install where it's gone through a few distributions. I think it's time for me to actually do a reinstall of this. I actually have upgraded a few servers this week doing the do release upgrade, and that is actually a fantastic tool to use over.
I've used that as well. Really, really cool.
So did I.
I got some family computers which I've upgraded, and in fact, one I started the upgrade and had to leave my computer, and for whatever reason, the SSH link died. I didn't know how to get it back. I was concerned if I just sort of rebooted it, logged back in, rebooted it, then it would be, you know, involve a massive trip to go and install it manually. But rebooted it, and the do release upgrade just picked up where it left off.
What's the difference between the do release upgrade then and aptitude dist upgrade?
Well, it's actually a wrapper. It's actually a Python wrapper that actually does apt stuff in the background. But one thing I find particularly useful is actually doing it over SSH. It detects you're actually doing it over SSH and actually opens up a separate SSH daemon on port 9002, I believe. So the idea is being that if the SSH session you're in dies, then you actually can still get into the server, which is really quite handy.
But I mean, there are other checks and things that it does. It'll disable third-party repositories in your sources.list, for example.
It doesn't sound hugely incredibly useful, to be honest.
Why?
Because I don't see what I get out of it over just running dist upgrade in a screen.
I've not read the code, so I don't know exactly what it does.
Well, the thing is, you just fire off one command and just forget about it.
Right? Do you not want to check what's going on?
Well, that's why I'm looking at the source code right as we speak.
So where's the time saving? Oh, yes, it's a really great script. I just have to poke through the source code to work out what it's doing. Oh, that helps me administer my systems.
I'm looking because I'm choosing to look. Now, if we're looking at everyday users who you do use servers, then they don't have to do that. They just have to fire off one command, do release upgrade, easy to remember, and it upgrades.
I'd be willing to bet you haven't looked at the source code for apt either, Tony.
No, I haven't, but I sit and watch what it's saying on the screen when I'm doing an upgrade, and I can spot the errors.
I tend to go and have a cup of tea. I can't imagine that the Ubuntu developers would come up with this wrapper for no reason. Yeah. There must be something
in
it.
I'm sure. I can't see what that is.
Out of five, what do you reckon?
I've got no real complaints. It works, so I'd probably say I'll go with Tony and go 4.5.
Simon, how about you? Yeah. Have you upgraded any machines?
Yeah, I've a number. I've been following on my Dell laptop from beta. That's upgraded continually through. I've done a fresh install on my daughter's laptop. I've done the remote install using do release upgrade, and I've done a fresh install on a new HP G6000, which was fine. Actually, the install was fine, but I've got graphic issues.
You've got NVIDIA.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I've tried to fix, but that's not really, I don't think, a Hardy Ubuntu issue at all, actually. So I'll probably go for
User failure.
Yeah. Anyway, it's not working.
We'll have a play with that.
Alan can promise to fix yours as well.
So, I'll match your 4.5. To be honest, I'd probably go for a 5. I've had absolutely no problems at all with it.
There was one server I upgraded this week. Now, I did a release from upgrade from DAP to Hardy, and I was actually quite concerned about this.
That there must, how old is Dapper now? That's 6.06.
That's probably, well, 2006, second half, middle.
Basically 2 years.
Yeah, so I mean, to do an upgrade from that, I mean, yeah, that's been tested well, this server. It was in use, and I was worried that some of the tweaks I'd possibly done wouldn't work through it for upgrade, and it worked fine, so.
But then 2 years isn't really all that long. It's seen quite a few Ubuntu revisions, but as Mark Shuttleworth said in the last show, you know, Debian will go from releases that are 3 or 4 or 5 years apart and effectively be a supported upgrade between those releases. So it is those kind of underpinnings that mean it should just work, upgrading it, 2 year upgrades.
Yeah. I mean, the actual upgrades work and the packages will work, but I'm talking about when these machines get heavily used and you install non-packaged software on there, I always get concerned when I'm upgrading them because they might get left behind.
Yeah, they don't get tested as thoroughly.
Yeah, I mean things like Zimbra and things like that. I mean, that was one I had to upgrade this week, and you know, I was quite concerned about that would just break with huge downtime, and when it just works, it really is a good feeling.
Laura, you've got a laptop there. Is that one that you've upgraded, or?
Yes, it's my Samsung Q35, and that upgraded okay. I wasn't that keen on Gutsy as a distribution. I can't remember exactly what, but I had all kinds of problems. And the sound now works.
That's a bonus.
Your card reader didn't work under Gutsy, did it?
Yeah, my card reader only works now because I've bought an SD card instead of an MMC card.
Have you tried an MMC card in there since the upgrade?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
And is that working now?
No.
Oh.
It's a non-issue.
I think Laura's not going to give it 5 out of 5.
I'm not giving it 5 out of 5 because the desktop effect still doesn't work.
How many? What out of 5?
4.
Four. Ooh. Still not bad.
Which is quite harsh around here, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've had a desktop that's been running Hardy since alpha, and I've had no problems with that. It's got dual screen, NVIDIA binary driver. It's got loads of stuff plugged into it, like USB, you know, keyboard and webcam and all kinds of funky stuff. USB sound card. I still have issues with the Pulse Audio because there's a game that I like to play that doesn't work with it. But I think that's a Pulse Audio ALSA OSS type issue, not a specifically Hardy issue. Although obviously upgrading to hardware, Hardy has broken that game for me. I've got a laptop, a Toshiba laptop that I've upgraded to Hardy. That just works, no problem at all. Everything works. Touch screen. It's a tablet as well. Card reader, network, sound, everything just works. I think the only thing I haven't actually tested is a modem because I never use a modem anymore. But yeah, everything works.
I remember you saying during the week you did actually have a problem upgrading insofar as you only had a couple of gigs spare on the disk. You didn't have
any space.
No,
that was on my Asus EPC. I ran out of disk space on that when I tried to upgrade to Hardy.
As I say, you only need that space for a short time whilst you actually do the upgrade, and then you have that space back again. I mean, yeah, that is potentially a bug.
No.
No, it's not.
It's delete some files. Be more organised and don't be such a hoarder.
I mean, what would be good is if the update thing said you have insufficient disk space to continue. I've never tried it on a system.
Yes,
with
it does.
It does do that.
It does exactly that.
So, the update manager can't give you more disk space.
Yeah, it's not going to magically.
No. What I mean is there potential for better organisation? So download packages as you're upgrading.
Actually, I've seen a couple of people mention a couple of things along this line, like, for example, downloading as you go and also asking all the questions up front. I think one of the guys on the Fresh Ubuntu podcast complained that the fact that he left his upgrade running and then in the middle of the night it stopped to ask him a question, and the next day he walks up to his machine thinking it would be finished and actually it's asking a question. It's a reasonable request to make, to say all the questions should be done up front. But one of the problems is that the questions that it asks are so late in the process that it's difficult for it to tell what questions it would need to ask until it gets into a situation where there's a resolution that needs, a conflict that needs resolving.
And presumably it's a bit of a catch-22, because on one hand you want to download the packages as you go, and on the other hand you want to download all the packages to get all the questions out of them, because those upgrade questions are part of those packages, to ask you all the questions at the beginning.
Yeah.
So if you download as you go, you can't get all the questions at the beginning. If you want all the questions at the beginning, you can't download as you go.
There's a corporate application that I use at work which has two methods for doing upgrades when you're upgrading it. One is downtime minimized and one is disk space minimized. So it could well be that in the future we have upgrades which have an option. You know, you can choose to have minimized downtime but takes up lots and lots of disk space because it brings down all the packages and then does a flip to turn all the new packages on and, you know, ask you all the questions and you deal with all of that up front, and then you just flick a switch and it's upgraded. Or a disk space minimized one where it downloads the packages as it needs it, but it takes a long time and you get a long amount of downtime. I don't know if that kind of thing would be possible with the upgrade tools.
Yeah, to actually have the choice between I think that's potentially a good idea.
Yeah, you write that.
Alan's score, what's your score?
I'd actually give it 4.5.
Wow.
Just because the sound didn't work, and it's not really a Hardy problem. And the sound does work on both my machines that I've upgraded, but it's just that one game that it's 4.75.
Oh.
All right, 4.75.
Right, who's going to work out the average of all those?
It's 4.45, thanks to my Ubuntu calculator. We give Ubuntu Hardy 4.45 out of 5.
The FSF approved distribution GNUSense, or nuisance. Possibly GNUSense, have released a new version based on Ubuntu Hardy.
New release, same old wireless problems.
Adobe are opening up the Flash formats, so this should mean that we'll get new, different implementations of FLV and SWF decoders and stuff.
Oh good, soon you'll be able to watch grannies falling off logs in total freedom.
The UK's Unix User Group has convinced the High Court to carry a judicial review of the British Standards Institute's decision to vote in favour of Microsoft's controversial OpenOffice XML format.
Wow, I think I'll have to hunt high and low for evidence for that one.
Spam is 30 years old.
Happy birthday.
Oh yeah, I think I got an e-card about that.
Sun are in the process of certifying Ubuntu.
What they give with one hand, they take away from MySQL with the other.
Okay, we've got Phil Newber on the phone to talk to us about his involvement in Ubuntu in the UK.
Hello, Phil.
Hello.
You're a member of the Ubuntu UK loco team. You hang around on IRC, you're on the mailing list. One of the things that I've noticed you've done a lot of is advocacy. You've got a blog. What's the website?
Yeah, it's crunchbang.org.
And it's syndicated on the Ubuntu UK Planet. And they're pretty much all advocacy and the odd rant here and there, I remember. So what made you start getting into Ubuntu then?
Well, I've used Ubuntu for a long time, actually. It's more a case of I'd set this blog up, so I've just, you know, something to do, and thought I'd, you know, write about my adventures with Ubuntu, really. That was it.
Do you use it on desktops, laptops, servers? What's your typical usage of it?
Yeah, I use it on all my machines. I've got several laptops and one desktop.
Do other members of the family get involved in that?
No, Becky, that's my partner, she still runs Windows, and Emma, that's our daughter, she's a Windows Vista. So I keep saying to her that, you know, I'll put Linux on there for her, and she keeps looking at me with big puppy dog eyes, oh, can you put Linux on, can you put Linux on? So Becky won't let me, so.
I had much the same with my wife when I first started showing her Linux. She was very reluctant, and then I just did it, and she had no choice.
Yeah. Well, she has said, actually, because apparently I'm getting married, she's looking at me now, giving me eagles.
Congratulations.
Yeah, well, apparently I'm getting married, she said that can be my wedding present. I can install Ubuntu on their machines.
That'll be one great wedding night, won't it?
Oh, my.
One thing that I've noticed that has been quite successful is the little advertisements that you've done for Ubuntu. They're all over the place. I've got them on my blog, and I know I see them pop up on various other Ubuntu websites. What prompted you to create those?
Yeah, they are all over the place. I keep bumping into them. It's bizarre when you sort of like browsing the web and you come across them, and I think, ooh, I did that. I don't know, really. I think I may have spotted a couple of messages on the mailing list. You know, some people saying, is there any adverts or anything that we can use to put on a website? So I thought, you know, I'd create something like that.
You've done little images for promoting OpenOffice, the GIMP, Firefox, and a few other applications. And have you had much feedback from people about them?
Yeah, I mean, the feedback was quite good, actually. I did the initial one. I did it in English. Well, I posted the images. I put up the GIMP files, basically, you know, if anybody wants to translate them, or, you know, here's the source files, do what you want with them. Within about an hour, I got a reply from some Spanish guy who translated them. What we got? Serbian, Russian, Elvish.
We were one step away from Klingon, aren't we, really?
What did we get? Elvish, Turkish, French, Polish, fantastic. Romanian, Japanese, Dutch, and Italian. So.
And they just all got emailed to you and you put them online and, you know, people can get them in their website?
Yeah, people emailed me about it and, you know, left comments saying I've done a Russian version and whatnot. It turned out to be quite a bit of work, actually. I think, you know,
particularly artistic, then?
I do a lot of pen and ink drawings and whatnot as well.
And you actually find that GIMP actually serves all your art purposes, do you?
Yeah, it's great for kit, really. I'm quite happily open up the GIMP and it can pretty much do anything I need it to.
Another thing I wanted to talk about was your fork of Ubuntu, which is Crunchbang.
Yes, Crunchbang.
How did that come about? What is it?
It's just a remastered version of Ubuntu, really.
What's different about it from Ubuntu?
Well, I think the main thing is it runs the OpenBox window manager instead of the full GNOME desktop environment. So.
And what's special about OpenBox?
What isn't special about No, it's OpenBox is great. It's lightweight. It's really configurable as well. Just through, you know, a few text files, you can edit your menus. You can edit startup programs.
So is it really good for old hardware? A bit like as Ubuntu is.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot lighter than the GNOME environment. I think it runs pretty well on new systems as well.
So why did you create a whole distribution? It must be a lot of work.
Well, I didn't really create the whole distribution, did I?
To be fair.
I mean, basically all it is Ubuntu, but it's just been, you know, tinkered with and probably mucked around more than it should have been, and stuck on a CD, and that's it, really.
Is it fairly straightforward to remaster the CD to put, like...
Yeah, I mean, I didn't find it particularly hard. It's I used the RemasterSys script. I mean, if you just go to Google and type in RemasterSys, you should find the homepage.
And do you think you'll be able to keep it up, making your own version of Ubuntu?
It's a lot of hard work, I'll say.
So. Yeah, because I actually sensed from your release notes that it was actually a bit of a tongue-in-cheek release for your first one. But now, is it starting to be serious?
No.
It's just a bit of a laugh and something to pass the time. Do you think once you get married there'll be other things calling on your time and you won't be able to spend as much time on this?
When we get married, no, probably I'll have more time to spend.
you've also, I know, applied for Ubuntu membership.
I mean, I don't know about you, Phil, but I mean, I certainly do have some sympathy for you, really, because I remember quite how nervous it was waiting for the process, you know, trying to understand what the process was. Am I really ready? Are they going to turn around and say no? I mean, the thing is, when you feel yourself...
You're not helping, Dave.
No, but I mean, I know some people, because, I mean, I have. I mean, I said that, you know, go for it. It's when you're actually trying to think yourself, am I ready? But and everyone around you is saying, yes, good, do it. You know, I'll back you up there. And you think, oh, it's really quite scary. So I just, you know...
Hang on, are we talking about him getting married, or are we talking about Ubuntu membership?
Well, I think a bit of both, to be fair.
Well, thank you for talking to us today, Phil. It's been really interesting. And good luck with the Ubuntu membership. You have to drop us a line and let you know if you let us know when you've been successful.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Will do.
Okay,
yeah.
And we'll speak to you soon. Cheers, Phil.
Yeah, cheers.
Bye.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
In episode 4, we asked you, what's the name of the free software-only official derivative of Ubuntu? And we were pleased and surprised at how many entrants we got. We had 79 correct answers. A couple of wrong ones included GNUSense and GNUbuntu, and also IceWeasel. The correct answer was, in fact, Gubuntu, and the winner is Mark Fowle. And he was selected at random by Mark Shuttleworth.
We'll send a token for the Canonical Store, and we'll have another competition in the next episode.
Congratulations.
Well done. So, have we got any emails this week?
Yeah, we've got quite a few. We've got one from Emmett Stewart, who says, who sent our names into space, which is really quite cool.
Into space?
Yeah, he's gone to NASA. I assume this is a scheme they're running rather than him personally contacting them, and included our names and the name of Mark Shuttleworth on a chip that will fly on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and we've got a certificate to prove it. So the Ubuntu UK podcast has just gone into space.
We have a correction from episode 3. We talked a little bit about virtualization, VMware parallels and that kind of stuff, and one term that we used was unified mode. We were talking about running Windows applications seamlessly in a window on your Ubuntu system, and in fact in VirtualBox, which is the application we were talking about at the time, it's actually not called unified mode, it's called seamless mode. So all those people who were googling for unified mode on VirtualBox and didn't find it, many apologies, it's seamless mode.
Yeah, and there's a wiki page on the Ubuntu wiki to tell you how to set it up.
Yeah, we'll link to that.
We had a comment on the blog from Kennedy808, don't have a real name, asking if we can set the genre tag on the files that we make available for download to podcast so that they can be sorted on his Archos MP3 player and I believe other MP3 players as well. And we're going to look into that. So hopefully when you get this episode, it will have the right genre tag.
Right, we spoke about sudo and security and things on the last podcast. Chris Oates emailed him about removing sudo escalation, and he suggested creating a button on one of the application bars, so you press the button and it removes sudo. So the command is simply sudo -k, and that's it. So as soon as you've finished with your sudo, punch the button and it's all gone, and your vulnerability is removed.
And we think Fedora has got an icon for that built onto its GNOME desktop that shows when you've got your sudo writes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I've seen that.
And you can kill it from that. But we don't have that on Ubuntu. Perhaps we should.
Yes.
One thing I got from somebody who'd listened to that podcast was that they misunderstood what you meant when you said sudo writes. And actually what you were talking about was sudo writes in that little pop-up dialogue that asks you for your password, as opposed to the command line, which wasn't always very clear.
That's not clear that when you're on the command line you type sudo, you're using sudo, but when you're using the GUI, just a box appears, doesn't it?
Asking you for your password, which is what you were talking about a lot of the
time. Right, okay. So, thanks for clarifying.
We had an email from Tony Arnold following our discussion on Unix malware in the last episode, and he says that weak passwords are still the major route by which Linux boxes are compromised, and that very often the compromise is not to get access to that machine, but to use it as a staging post to attack other boxes as part of a distributed sort of denial of service. He also mentions that a live CD version of a distro ran with an SSH daemon activated activated by default with a very easily guessed default password. He had a machine compromised via that route. It really pays to be careful about your passwords and how you manage them and what services you're running. So that's a sensible message, really.
We had an email from Thomas from Vienna, Austria, that wanted to drop us a line to say thanks for the podcast and how much he actually likes it. He's saying he switched from Ubuntu 1 month ago and is using free software 90% of the time. He's saying how great it is to be part of the community.
Nice one. Welcome, Thomas.
Thanks for the mail, Thomas.
You can contact us by the usual means. Email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
Or you can leave up to 30 seconds of voicemail at 0845 508 1986.
You can also follow our Twitter feed, which is twitter.com/UUPC.
Or you can interact with the Ubuntu UK community via the IRC channel, #Ubuntu-UK, on the Freenode network.
We also have a Facebook group. Search for Ubuntu UK Podcast on Facebook and you'll find us. And if you add the Linux application on Facebook, we are available as a podcast in that, and it's possible then to play the latest episode through your Facebook profile.
It does that automatically, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit scary.
Yeah.
And that about wraps up the emails.
Okay, and that's the end of the show. I'd like to say thanks to our guests. We had Laura, Pete and Phil.
Thank you to our sponsors, Show Me Do and Bitfolk.
The next episode is going to be recorded at UDS in Prague without me.
Yeah, sorry about that, Simon.
Sorry, Si. We'll send you a postcard.
Thanks.